You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend, and joining us today is Dr. Tom Fullerton. Dr. Fullerton is a professor of economics in the College of Business Administration, and he's no stranger to KTEP, a good friend of the station. And we're here to talk about, what we can expect in the future as far as this coming year and the Borderplex Economic Outlook. That's the publication that Tom's office always puts out, and they always have a conference. And, well, I'll go ahead. First of all, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us here today.
Oh, thank you, Louis. Glad to be here.
But I was going to say, in the past, it was Norma and I who would always kind of MC this, and then Norma took off, and you said you couldn't find me anywhere.
I could not find you, but I tried.
So it was easier to predict the economic outlook than to find Louis or Norma.
Well, I guess since Norma's in a different time zone, technically you are correct.
Okay. Well, first of all, as we're getting ready to bring in and inaugurate the president-elect, new president, does that have a big effect at all on the economy, the stock market? I know that after the election, it did somewhat.
Yes. Let's see, the stock market went in the exact opposite direction of what had been predicted. Things have kind of leveled off, and I imagine that, the stock market will cool down after the inauguration takes place. But normally, these things should not cause very many ripples in an economy as large and advanced as the United States. But this time, there is more uncertainty than usual because there have been so many different and so many wildly exaggerated policy positions that were adopted during and after the campaign. And so a lot of people are very concerned about what's going to happen. And some of those concerns have direct regional importance here in the Borderplex. So macroeconomically, things are very stable. I guess if you're going to face this type of uncertainty, right now the economy is in about as good a shape as it can be in order to be able to shoulder these types of uncertainties. But it does make things very abnormal in terms of trying to understand what is likely to transpire the rest of this year and in 2018, when that is the year when the first Trump administration budget will really come to pass. The budget, the federal budget for 2017, you know, that's already cooked into the outlook by virtue of being adopted during the Obama administration. But 2018, a lot of people are saying all bets are off. That's going to be the first genuine Trump year, and nobody knows what's likely to happen.
And one of the things that people talk a lot about is the fact that the United States has been in a deep hole financially for the past years, and that's especially owing I don't know how many zeros added to China.
Yeah, luckily things are much, much better than they were in 2009. You know, Bush 43 ended up presiding over, just a horrible economic and financial debacle here in the United States. It was the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Since then, we've piled up a lot of debt. But we've done it without inflationary consequences because the financial markets and the banking system had collapsed. And so it was better to pile up that debt than to head in the direction of 25% unemployment, which is what we saw towards the end of the Herbert Hoover administration. We avoided that fate. Barack Obama and his team are turning over an economy that's in about as good a shape as you could expect. But the Achilles heel of all this is that mountain of debt that is out there. And it's not clear that the Trump administration is really going to focus on balancing the budget and beginning to whittle down that debt. It'd be nice if we could go back to the 1990s when President Bill Clinton was in office, because not only did he balance the books, he also began paying off the accumulated debt. We really would benefit if we could head in that direction.
Now, as far as what we saw earlier, because this last year was just a year of complete surprises. Everybody was saying, the Cubs win the World Series. everything is happening that is not supposed to happen. And one of those things was, what happened with Britain and
the Brexit.
The rejection, yes.
Yes, there are a lot of things going on. Part of all the voter discontent worldwide is dissatisfaction with globalization. A recent study showed that, surprisingly, the two groups that benefited during the globalization acceleration period from the 1990s forward have been high-income earners. That doesn't really surprise anybody. The other group was low-income earners, which, guess what? It means the people that were lagging behind were the majority. That was the middle-income earners. And the middle-income earners, rose up and voted against globalization. We saw it during the Democratic primary when a guy with really bad economic policy proposals, Bernie Sanders, almost won the nomination. And then we saw it on the Republican side when a guy who has potentially worse economic recommendations than Senator Sanders won not only the Republican nomination, but also won the electoral vote, the Electoral College vote, and Donald Trump is now the president-elect. It's a very weird year. It was sort of more extreme than 2000. And of course, we remember in 2000 we had a similar situation when one candidate won the popular vote, but another candidate won the Electoral College vote. And so there was a lot of discontent internationally by voters all over the world, and the United States was part and parcel of that whole package.
Shortly after the election, we interviewed a political science professor at Rice University and then also a journalist with Gannett, and they talked about the fact that perhaps because this election caught everyone by surprise, and as you remember, a lot of the pundits were on there and saying, not only do we have egg on our face, we have an omelet. And one of them said, the problem is that we didn't pay attention to the working class, blue-collar person. Is that true?
Probably. Not everybody was caught by surprise, though. If you notice, all of the surveys and the polls indicated that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. And the econometric models all indicated that Donald Trump was going to win the election, in part due to voter fatigue. Anytime you have one party in the White House for consecutive terms, that always translates into a lot of votes in favor of the other party. And the econometric models consistently across the board indicated that Donald Trump would win. It was Hilly versus Donnie, and Donnie won, and that's what the econometric models indicated. I kept warning my econometrics class, all the polls say that Hilly's going to win, but all the econometric models say that Donnie's going to win. And the day after the election, my students were laughing at me. They were saying, oh, the econometric models won. I said, but do they look at policy seriousness? the polling approach, overlooked certain things. This time around, it's one of those situations when the polls and the econometric models disagree. It's anybody's guess as to what's going to happen. And really, that's what ultimately prevailed, because the popular vote was won by one candidate, but the Electoral College was carried by the other candidate. That's about as close as you can get to a 50-50 outcome. And so, when you have elections where the polls and the econometric models both point to the same outcome, then you're on safe ground in terms of predicting the election. But when you've got a year like this year where they disagree with each other, it's anybody's guess, because they kept talking about Hillary Clinton's leads in the polls. Well, those surveys give probabilities, but they don't give absolute outcomes, and they don't give vote tallies. And so a 55% probability of winning still means that the other candidate has a 45% probability of winning. And in baseball, a 45% probability is really great if you're a hitter.
Tell us a little bit about, first of all, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that you host a summit every year here at UTEP, and you have some pretty heavy hitters. But the fact that they come in and they talk about the labor market, spending, the economy. Tell us a little bit about that summit, and this is what the maybe
the 12th.
12th, wow, okay. So tell us about how this came all about.
Well, the Border Economic Forum was started way back in the 1990s. We held an economic forum during the 1996 election, And it wasn't called the Border Economic Forum at that point, but it was very popular, well attended, very popular. It was over in the old Neal Auditorium in the College of Business Administration, which no longer exists. But it went well. And then, let's see, the Border Region Modeling Project was just being organized. And so, the Border Economic Forum was launched the next year, proved popular. We held it for about 9 consecutive years. And then there was a hiatus. And then we revived it a few years back under Dean Bob Nachman in the College of Business Administration. It's been well attended since, and we've continued to do it. This year, we looked at regional energy issues. The Hunt Institute for Global Competitiveness just released an energy report for this region. And so their executive director, Patrick Schaefer, looked at all of the, the electricity issues facing the region. He looked at the petroleum industry, the hydrocarbons industry, including natural gas. And he looked at policy issues that segment the regional energy situation between 3 states and 2 nations. And so that was the first part of the conference, and very interesting. Got a lot of positive feedback about that. Then Adam Walkie from the Border Region Modeling Project in the Department of Economics and Finance here at UTEP looked at recent business cycle developments, and specifically with an eye to this region, Las Cruces, El Paso, Juarez, and Chihuahua City. To close out the forum, a presentation was made by some unknown economics professor looking at, the regional econometric outlook using simulations generated by the 255 equation Borderplex econometric model that's housed at UTEP. And so that was what was organized this year. It was well attended, and subsequent to that, all 3 of the speakers have been receiving a lot of engagement requests to go off campus and address different community and business groups.
Let's talk a little bit about the Borderplex Economic Outlook. How long has this been put out, this publication?
The first publication was published in 1998. It took, 2 years to get everything up and running. Fall of 1996, the decision was made to build a regional econometric model focused mainly on El Paso and Juarez. And step 1 was to begin putting together data banks. It was surprising how big the data gap was. But started to put together a data bank, asymmetric in its coverage because we deal with different regional and national statistical reporting systems in Mexico and the United States. But it was put together, and then, in 1997, the software was acquired to begin writing the code for the modeling system. And then, once the model was up and running, it began to be simulated, and the first report was released in 1998. And short-term cyclical forecasts have been generated every year since then. So there have been 18 consecutive years' worth of forecasts. This is the only large-scale cross-border econometric model in existence in North America, possibly in the world, although I won't rule out the possibility of some Asian countries or European countries also having econometric forecasting models in place that model within one system cross-border economic relations the way that this system does. But this is the only one along the U.S.-Mexico border, and I believe it's the only one along the U.S.-Canadian border as well. So it's a fairly unique tool, and it kind of sets UTEP apart from other border institutions.
If you wouldn't mind, if we just kind of go through the Borderplex Economic Outlook 2-18, and it talks a little bit, first of all, about the demographics in El Paso. And I think a lot of people notice that with all the things going on with the freeway and the new buildings and everything else, that El Paso is growing, but they're not really sure as how big and what the demographics are.
Well, there's about 830,000 people within El Paso County alone, another 6,000 people across the line in Hudspeth County that are part of this metropolitan economy as defined by the Census Bureau. In terms of population changes, The biggest change has been that there was a three-year period during which the population growth rate in El Paso was below 1%. It was below the national rate of change, and that almost never happens here. El Paso generally grows at twice the national rate in terms of population. But what was happening during that three-year period was the hydraulic fracturing and the horizontal drilling revolutions were taking place in the Permian Basin, the Eagle Ford Shale, and other regions of the country. And there were energy jobs available at a mass scale very close to El Paso. And so a lot of working-age adults took advantage of those red-hot labor markets in places like Midland and Odessa and moved out of El Paso. Then, beginning in 2015, all of a sudden petroleum prices started descending back to earth. And so 2016, all of a sudden, we saw a reversal in population growth, went back up to double the national average. We predict it to remain, above the national average, roughly double the national average, both this year as well as 2018. That's what people are accustomed to, although any public administrator will say it's got a lot of headaches associated with it because guess what? Not only is population growing, vehicle registrations are growing even more rapidly because El Paso, even though it's, you know, it ranks low nationally in the United States, on a global scale, El Paso is a relatively prosperous metropolitan economy. And all these people with all this money are buying more cars or buying cars at a rate that's faster or exceeds the rate of household formation. And so that congestion you spoke about, it's going to become worse in future years, at least during this period when the infrastructure system is being expanded and modified and improved with regard to surface transportation. One thing that we're lacking in all these plans is a four-lane highway through the Anthony Gap, which means that all those containers getting loaded up in Santa Teresa, if they're headed to Houston or Points East, they've got to go straight through downtown El Paso. If we had a four-lane connector between I-10 through the Anthony Gap over to US 54, which then goes down to a connection with Loop 375, that would go a long way towards making this transition and investment period more manageable. But hey, those are the cards we've been dealt with. And traffic congestion, is especially on the west side, is going to remain a fixture, at least for the foreseeable future. That's not the most popular aspect of this forecast, I might add.
What about the labor growth in the job market, and also what kind of jobs are coming to El Paso?
Okay, the job market is doing pretty well. We anticipate, based on the model simulations, that the unemployment rate is going to hover right around 5% both this year and next year. And, you know, last year it was a little bit below 5%, at least according to the preliminary statistics. The last time we had a three consecutive year period where unemployment was 5% or lower in El Paso was prior to 1973. So this is a big change. In terms of the composition of jobs, a lot of people complain about the composition of jobs in El Paso. But guess what? Per capita incomes have increased steadily since the 1990s. They've actually increased steadily from 1969 forward. They haven't kept pace with the nation or the state as a whole, but that's because of labor force quality issues. We need to increase educational attainment. We've been doing it. We've had a 20-year effort in place. You know, back in the mid-1990s, it was spearheaded by the Greater El Paso Chamber of Commerce. We need another 20 years at least of sustained effort in terms of improving educational attainment. And as we do that, just like the previous 20 years indicate, incomes are going to continue rising. One thing that is on the horizon, you know, technical professions are gaining in popularity, and those jobs are available. In El Paso, probably the most prominent sector is the healthcare sector, but we'll probably have defense industry spinoffs in the future as well. Aerospace manufacturing and aerospace investments are likely to occur in part due to the emergence of the aerospace manufacturing industry in Mexico and in part due to UTEP research efforts out at the Fabens Airport. Beyond that, let's see, one area which might seem surprising but is going to contribute to improvements both in the labor market and in the income profiles of the region is the fact that the national unemployment rate currently is below 5%. Whenever that's happened during the past two decades, it's always translated into new call center investments, both here and to a lesser extent in Las Cruces. And when the unemployment rates are so low, guess what? It's not the old style low-level call centers that begin investing in El Paso and Las Cruces. It's the bilingual call centers, and it's the ones that have more technical requirements, and they have higher wages and salaries attached to them. So there's a lot going on in the labor market. Most of it is pretty good, and we can continue to rack up those successes if we're able to continue to increase educational attainment at the post-secondary level. In other words, we need to convince kids to stay in school, graduate high school, and then either enroll and complete technical institute programs, community college programs, or four-year university college programs.
Discussing and talking about education, you and I have discussed this in the past, Tom, and we have also disagreed with other people call the brain drain.
Yes, the brain drain. During the late 1990s, the unemployment rate in El Paso was at about 11% per year. The national unemployment rate was 5% or lower. Well, anytime you have a situation where one regional economy has a jobless rate that's more than double another regional economy's, there's going to be a natural flow of people from the high unemployment region into the low unemployment region. What's happened whenever El Paso has had, unemployment rates that match or converge towards the national unemployment rate or the Texas state unemployment rate, you see the reversal. And we've seen that during the 2000s. We've seen that reversal and had years where there have been literally thousands of people moving into the El Paso region. Recently, there was a red-hot labor market out in the energy patch. We had people moving out of El Paso. That's cooled off, and it's coincided with a period where the local jobless rate is essentially matched the national jobless rate. And guess what? Net migration in this forecast is positive. Positive and is projected to remain positive over both years of the forecast period. Brain drain rhymes, but it doesn't really represent reality. The fact of the matter is that El Paso is one of the most popular destinations for adult working age individuals of anywhere in the country. Whenever there are job openings in El Paso, guess what? Local organizations are flooded with resumes. The worst committee you can be on at UTEP, by the way, is a faculty recruitment committee, because you're going to have to wade through literally boxes of resumes, and it's legally required. You have to go through each and every one. So anybody out there, even in the private sector, watch out if you get on a job recruitment committee, because El Paso is a popular destination. It's been that way for years. It's going to continue to be that way in the future.
And one of the things that has happened in the past, and we've discussed this as well, is that a lot of people who are in the defense industry or in the military end up coming to El Paso and staying here.
That's correct. There are several thousand retired Department of Defense individuals that are here because of the weather, cost of living, the quality of life, the presence of William Beaumont Army Medical Center and the VA Center here. And there are a lot of, people who have retired from different branches of the military. For the most part, it's the Army, but there's individuals from all the branches of the military who, after they retire from their active duty, then seek out private sector careers or public sector careers here in this region. El Paso and Las Cruces offer a good quality of life. The people that are in the military, they know which side the divide they want to be on, and then a lot of them come here and have professional careers after their military service is over. And so, there's nothing to suggest that pattern is going to change. If anything, it's likely to intensify in the future.
Sometimes people will make fun of us because they'll say, you guys are excited because this company is coming to your town or this store. But it's not that it's excitement. It's the fact that there are more jobs and, again, additional things to do and improving the quality of life, like you said earlier. The fact that we have a medical school, we have a minor league baseball team, and other things happening here in El Paso that were not here in the 1960s, 1970s.
Well, people from outside this region always comment, wow, in El Paso, it's great. Everybody's always in a good mood. And people who are in a good mood, they use lots of excuses. They're creative in coming up with excuses to throw a party or a celebration. That's why CBS keeps coming back for the Sun Bowl every year. We know how to throw a celebration here. And see, whenever there is a big announcement in terms of, new product development or new business investments, we like to enjoy that. And, it's not that we're going overboard. It's just that's just the nature of this region. And people from outside notice it and they like it. That's why one reason the worst committee to be on at UTEP is a faculty recruitment committee, because all those academics out there understand it as well.
One of the things that we're running out of time here, but the fact that you talk about, money being spent here because of perhaps people who come here for the Sun Bowl. El Paso is no longer a place where you drive through, but you actually stop here and do things. But there's also a big number of people who cross the border every day and spend money here.
That's correct. Now, in recent months, customers from northern Mexico are spending less than they otherwise would have, because erosion in the exchange rate value of the peso has damaged their purchasing power. And so, there's less goods and services being sold to consumers from northern Mexico than otherwise would have been the case. But it's another feature of the landscape. And by the way, we also, people who reside on this side of the river also travel into Mexico frequently. And, it's part of their business makeup as well. And there's an increasing number of people in 2017 who are crossing the river because their purchasing power has declined in recent months. But our purchasing power, once you convert from dollars into pesos, has increased. And so there's always two-way border traffic going on, whether it's job-related or whether it's, consumption-related. But it's a great place to live in. A lot of people refer to El Paso and Juarez as your two-nation vacation.
And that rhymes, too.
It does, and it's accurate.
Tom, thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Dr. Tom Fullerton. Dr. Fullerton is a professor of economics in the College of Business Administration, and we've been talking about the Borderplex Economic Outlook to 2018, also looking back at 2017, 2016, and also a little bit of what we may expect with the new Trump administration. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Louis.
The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Luis Sainz.